Welcome to Casterbus. This is the podcast for older Doctor Who fans who like other TV shows and movies as well. Let's put it that way. And I'm Christian Corley. James McLean is joining me in a little while. I just wanted to say a big hello to our new Patreon followers. So it's a big hello to Derek Arnold. Hi there, Derek. And hello to someone who's simply called Sarah. They've joined us on Patreon to help support the podcast. You can join on Patreon. There's different tiers available, including paid tiers with a free onboarding. So you can try it out and see if you like it or not. You will get longer editions of the podcast using that method. So if you join the Patreon, you get the full length podcast. If you prefer to just listen to this podcast on Spotify or through Apple Podcast or wherever you get your podcast from, then you'll get the cut down version. You don't lose anything tangible by not doing the full version, but long term, it'd be great if you could come with us onto Patreon and support the show that way. Having a chat this week about events, Doctor Who events, things you can do that are Doctor Who themed. I'm off to London next week, and my children want to do something, but these things tend to be booked out. Now, I don't know if there's a Doctor Who escape room in London, but there's like all sorts of events. There's like there's the Shrek World, for instance. Now, last time we went to London, we thought, oh, let's do Shrek World. And then we looked into it, and you couldn't get close to it for like 6 weeks or something like that. You have to book a long time in advance. Now, when I was a kid, you could just turn up at places, couldn't you? You just turn up, maybe queue for a bit, and get in. But these days, you have to book in advance for a lot of things, which really annoys me.
But is that because families are nicer these days in some respects? Do dads and mothers, and are they going out to places more?
It could be that. Well, do you know, it could be that. I hardly went anywhere when I was a child.
Well, nor did I.
Yeah.
So my holiday in the summer would be to my grandmother's place in Herefordshire or my other grandmother's place in Reading.
Right.
There was no, I mean, others did. I know other people got trips abroad or went different places, but my dad liked to keep his wallet close to his chest.
Yes.
And those were the alternatives. So we didn't do much. I remember going to Madame Tussauds once when I was, you know, pretty young, but I don't think that was with my dad. And that's when they had the Doctor Who exhibition then with Tom Baker and Meg Loss and the like.
Oh, wow. I don't know if I ever saw that. I did go to Madame Tussauds. I also had an elderly relative that we stayed with quite often. My dad's elder sister by about 16 years. We used to stay with her in St. Albans, it was. And we'd regularly trip into London, but we never went abroad. And I always remember this, we always went on holiday every 2 years, whether to that relative's house or another relative's house, or staying with relatives in some sort of organised scenario. But it was always every 2 years. My best friend, his parents were driving around Europe every single summer.
Mm, yeah, exactly. Do you think some of it is to do with changes in parents, and also visibility? Like, you said Shrek and the 6 weeks waiting list. Now, you'd commonly think you'd take, say, maybe an 8-year-old, 10-year-old to Shrek. Now, you know, Shrek is, you know, over 20-year-old property. Mm. So it's going to be dads and mums who'll be going to Shrek as much as the kids going to Shrek. Same with Doctor Who. You know, we are now more sort of openly youthful as middle-aged people than people were 20, 30 years ago. So we go to these spaces because we want to go to them as much as the kids. So does that sort of create a greater flow into these activities? And also, in terms of visibility, people love to have things they can put on their feeds. Look what, yes, I've done. You know, there's that need to show, oh, look, I've been on holiday. Look, I've done this. You know, I am living my life. There's that sort of pressure of social media. Does that drive people into going out more, not just to things like that, but to restaurants and, you know, excursions just to show that they are a great family, they're a great mum or a great dad, or just, you know, living their single life, whatever. And maybe that's also what increases. Or maybe back then there were 6 weeks waits as well, and we just weren't aware of them because we didn't get to go to these places.
Indeed, yes, maybe. I don't think there was. And there's a lot more of them these days as well. So do you remember? Because, as I said, these things have kind of developed. They've developed in all manner. They've become more sophisticated. They take up more space. They're in all different types of shapes and sizes. You know, you've got big sort of conventions. You've got semi-permanent exhibitions and museum-type places. You've got escape rooms. And when I was a kid, you know, you'd go to these things and they were quite, I don't want to say murky, but it was very autatty, but they kind of were in a way, weren't they?
I think that still happens, though, doesn't it? I remember going to Disney World for the first time, and I know The Simpsons has made jokes about this 100 times, but I remember going to Epcot Center and seeing, you know, this would be like in early 2000s, late 1990s maybe, and they were still pioneering those massive virtual reality goggles as, you know, the way of the future, which they probably had in that exhibition for the last 15 years. You know, things get tatty very quickly, don't they? I think it's probably quite hard to, especially if you've got a flow of traffic and people just can't keep their fingers to themselves. Have to touch and press and push and pull everything, which I don't want to sound like a grumpy old man, but...
Well, you are.
I can stop it, yeah.
a few years ago, a gentleman called Brian Terranova came to stay with me for a few days.
Okay.
And we went
it's
to
a funny name.
It is, isn't it? Yes.
Brian.
And we went to the Doctor Who exhibition at the Life Centre in Newcastle upon Tyne.
It's a bit like having a name which is brain, but you're too stupid to spell it right.
Hi, Brian.
Terranova's not listening to this.
Anyhow, and it had only been open a few weeks, but, you know, it was quite tatty by that point. And you can kind of understand why all these Daleks got, tatty, really, can't you? Now they had to be constantly kind of repainted and patched up before they were reused. Cause, you know, there was like three or four Daleks the BBC had, and they'd get sent out to be props and display units in shop windows and things, didn't they, between episodes or between series.
But even when things are kept on like permanent display, you know, rot starts to, unless you've got very good methods of curation. I mean, like the Blackpool exhibition for Doctor Who, that most of the stuff in there was, you know, damn rotten because, you know, time does that. So there's that factor as well, is the actual exhibition pieces need a lot of maintenance to keep things looking cool. It's always been the way. The best things, I think, are the non-permanent, because they don't have time to do that. And I suppose because they're on for a fixed period, there's more of a focus on keeping things up to date. But even then, I mean, like I did that, you remember a few years ago, the crash of the Elysium live theatre thing that they had in Ipswich, which went down on behalf of Gustavus, if I recall. And because that was a live kind of interactive theatre performance that was on for a certain amount of time, it never got I don't think it really had the opportunity to start feeling tatty. Maybe some of the things at the beginning that you have to wear were a little bit because they would get constant use. But overall, yeah, it's hard to keep these things feeling, you know, fresh, clean when they have a constant flux of grubby humans.
Was that you who went to the crash of the Elysium?
Yeah, that was me.
Oh, I was thinking it was Philip Bates.
No, it was me. I think I might have gone with my sister.
Right. So you went in July. I'm just pulling up the podcast for that. You went in July 2012. We spoke to
2012,
12 years ago.
My God.
And we spoke to Tom McRae, who scripted it a couple of months before that, which is also a podcast. I'll link to those in the show notes. Tom McRae interview is quite good. He was walking to a railway station, I think, as I interviewed him.
I mean, if you can time travel, I'd recommend it. Head back to 2012 and give it a go.
Was it good?
Also, It wasn't for me. I think it was a good bit of live interactive theatre.
Right.
And if you're into that sort of stuff, I think it works. I mean, there were some moments where they sort of captured the television, like they would have the Weeping Angel coming down the dark corridor, and they would have the lights strobing on and off as it was moved down. So you'd get that sort of sense. But as we've said before, and a bit like Brain Terra Nova, I kind of like perfection in models, in props, in I like accuracy. It's why I find cosplay hard, because cosplay always makes you feel like a second-rate version of what you are trying to homage. But equally, sort of live interactive theatre will never have the sense and feeling of it being real, because you are never totally immersed, because you can't be. So I kind of struggled with it a bit, and my brain is
Okay.
watching the acting and seeing the gaps and the tricks, and watching the other people in your party engage. And overall, I find that a deeply dissatisfying feeling. But some people love it, so go them.
Yes, go them, go them. When Doctor Who came back in 2005, it was it had a very different sort of reputation to what it has now, and also what it had in some 2010, we'll say 2012, when you went to Crash of the Elysium. And there was a period, the 90s in particular, where it was kind of the whole convention scene was kind of tatty, and then the convention scene started building back up again when Doctor Who came back. And I went again with Brian Terranova on a different visit to the UK, to a local convention in Teesside at the, I think it was called, what was it called? It was called Dimensions. It had previously been Dimensions on Tyne when it was
I
held in
see.
Newcastle, but they ended up moving it to Stockton-on-Tees, so they just called it Dimensions. And we went to that, and it was okay, it was good, the talks were good, but there wasn't an awful lot to look at, and what there was to look at was a touch on the tatty side. Mr. Cavanagh was there as well. We met up with Gareth and had a drink with Mark Strickson, of all things. You
Cool.
name dropper. Now, that convention, compared to what I went to a few years later in Cardiff, it was the thing in Cardiff was on another level completely. It was organized at a different level. There was, people knew where they were going and where they were supposed to go. There's clear signage. There was multiple things taking place at any one time. Not just two things, I'm sorry, like three or four things taking place at any one time. There was a section that was for video games, for the I think we were talking about the PlayStation and PC game that was around at the time. In fact, whilst I watched people playing that, the people watching it were actually Stephen Moffat and his children playing that game. And, there was just such a lot going on. It was very polished and organized. And obviously, it was in a nice, shiny new venue in Cardiff, as opposed to Dimensions, which was in a hotel which is now no longer standing. It's been completely demolished. It was an old, aging, creaking old hotel. So it's Doctor Who. I'm not saying it doesn't take place in creaking old hotels anymore, convention things, but the whole convention thing's kind of it's hit a specific level of having to be particularly sophisticated, I think. And if you can't reach any sort of level of sophistication, then you're going to look either cheap, or you're going to have to refocus your efforts into a very small thing. Now, I'm talking a lot here. I don't normally talk this much. But when we did the in 2018, when we did the convention in Manchester for Gareth, which we mentioned a few weeks ago, that I think the perfect venue, reasonably well organized under the circumstances. Things did go wrong as we mentioned then, but it was quite good. And I think that also reached a particular level of sophistication, whereas it's hard to think of going backwards from that for me.
I think the first thing is there are sort of, as you've alluded to, very different frameworks for these conventions, and a lot of them depend on the type of organisers, the type of people involved in a higher level, but also how they're financed, where the money comes from. And I think, yeah, the 2018, it was the VWAP, wasn't it?
VWAPCon.
Yeah. Was particularly unusual in the fact that it didn't the money wasn't offset onto the participant, the person coming, the attendee. It wasn't as some are, you know. So, I mean, I've been to conventions where they are quite pricey up front.
Yeah.
But the upside is, and the only way they survive is you have a good showrunner who can manage, create a quality experience, which means they'll come back and they'll keep paying that because they're either, like you said, they're intimate or they're very, very clean and well organized, so everything moves and runs smoothly. And then you also get the big ones, obviously, as we've seen, certainly in the sort of bigger cities, London, Manchester, Milton Keynes, of these kind of sort of cattle market cons, if to use a kind of brutal word, where it is a low cost to get in. There's a lot, but really all you've got is often normally it's in sort of like a market space, a closed off market space where there'll be tables for you to buy stuff, merchandise. There might be a few rows of tables with some celebrities that you can get paid signed photos of. And there may be a small corner where there's a couple of talks, but ultimately, you know, they're not actually particularly glamorous. And unfortunately for Doctor Who, you know, a lot of those London ones are where you get the big names and the big prices in terms of actually getting the autographs and the photos. And that's how they work. So I think it depends on the type of convention, who's organising it. Say, if it's affiliated with something like the BBC, that's obviously going to give it a certain more lavishness. If it's aiming at just being kind of, like I say, a through flow of pedestrian traffic rather than fans, which some of those London ones are, where you feel they're cheap enough that anyone can go to and then mingle, and as well as the people are willing to pay the high prices. Or, as I said, the ones I used to quite like, which a guy called Sean used to run, I don't know if he still does, he did them predominantly around Stargate and Buffy. He did try Doctor Who very early on. I remember him saying it was, at the time, this was sort of early 2000s, late 1900s, it wasn't a good space for Doctor Who. And I remember him saying the reason it wasn't was that other fans liked to go out and party at the end, but Doctor Who fans wanted to be in bed by about 10, 10:30, which kind of killed the late night flair. But if you went to sort of the Buffy ones, they'd be dancing all night and they would all be down on the dance floor. And, you know, what was it, Andy Hallis was his name, the who passed, who did Angel? He would be down there singing, and you know, they'd all be there having fun, but that wasn't kind of where it was, according to Sean, back in the sort of. I think that probably shifted and changed once Doctor Who came back, and suddenly it got a new crowd, which weren't, as you'd say, the sort of cadaver-like remains of fandom that had existed since 1989. There was an influx of new young blood who were. Different types of people, so I think it's probably changed since then. But yeah, I mean, the history of conventions, fandom, how it all works. I did the Babylon 5 one in 1999, I think it was, which was, I think, the first one I ever went to, which was in Blackpool, which I think was still the biggest Babylon 5 one they ever did. And there was massive issues with the organisation there. For the signing queues was like a 3-hour one because they didn't have the attendees and people were just walking past the queues and going in. So there was a static queue for like 3 hours.
Right.
And the cast did overtime to make up for that. So, and it's easy to happen. I know it's easy to go, how can you let that happen? But these, you know, when you've got big events, and I think that one had like 20 principal cast characters, all there, everyone was there. I think J. Michael Straczynski was still writing season 5 while he was there.
Wow.
You know, it was a really weird, and a unique space. And Gareth Thomas was there as well from Blake 7 because Straczynski was a massive fan of Blake 7. So they brought him in. He was mildly inebriated, would be a kindness. But so that was a mixture of being very interesting and very big. But again, the organisation, it can just be very easy for it to all fall apart. But these, I think the best conventions to me are the ones which don't actually look lavish, but like you said, they run well, and there's a certain amount of intimacy. And if you can manage to make that not too much of a financial burden on the participant, especially if it's a weekender, and you can get them to get a good rate for them at the hotel. If you do it at a hotel, which is what Sean used to do, he'd find a London hotel, he'd get good rates for people to come. It would be like a Friday to Sunday, and there'd be stars would be there all the way through. You got a good atmosphere, and it was, and especially the UK is kind of, I think what we're quite good at, which according to people I met there, some of the casts from various shows, the US is a lot more, it's kind of standoffish, while the British seem to tend to be a little more relaxed with the celebrities, and that relaxes them as well.
Right.
I don't know whether that's, you know, just apocryphal, that's just one perspective, but yeah, they were very, you know, those are the good places. Like you say, ones where you can end up having a drink with Mark Strickland, you know, That's cool, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what you've described there, those sort of intimate, smaller events, and we talked to Gareth about this some years ago in a podcast called How to Organise a Doctor Who Convention with Gareth Cavanagh, because Gareth used to do this quite regularly. He used to run a pub, and he'd have small events in his pub.
It's almost like we should have had him on, really, isn't it, for this? You know, if we were going to have a guest on to talk about this,
he'd be perfect.
Not, yeah, that or Horns of Nylon. That's his own.
But yeah, he did various ones. He did one about Doctor Who comics specifically, and one about Doctor Who novels called, I think they called that one NovelCon. And that was the thing. So you'd and then there's a few others that he did later on in other places. But that was the thing. You'd have a small event in a pub. We'd have some really good guests. I remember interviewing Gary Russell, and I've also interviewed who else was there that day? It might have been a different one. There was one where I interviewed Andrew Smith as well. So there's the audio for those floating around somewhere. I'm not sure where they are right now, but the gist is you get up close to people that you know and recognise, and have a chat with them about Doctor Who, and then there'd be a talk about it, and maybe some clips and video and what have you, and something else going on. And nice and compact and organised, because, you know, you've only got one room, maybe two, so everything has to be organised in that respect. So, those were good little events. I mean, it would have been good to have Gareth on for this, but it's unfortunately we didn't. But
good excuse.
Good excuse. Well done. Well done, yes.
It would have been good to have had him on for this, but we didn't.
I'll probably cut that bit out. I'm just trying to find my flow. I am minded of what you were saying a few minutes ago concerning drinking with guests and what have you, of those sci-fi cruises.
Oh, yeah.
Which... I occasionally see people pop up. I think maybe Fraser Hines has done one relatively recently, and a few other people. A sci-fi sea cruise. I mean, I'll be honest with you, I like a bit of sci-fi. I can't think of anything worse than being on a cruise ship.
But I mean, I suppose it does trap you with the guests. Yes. I suppose that's the... I mean, it's more of an American thing. You see them for Star Trek. Battlestar Galactica's done them as well. I don't know whether it's really, you know... has been a Doctor Who thing, but do you say this kind of like general sci-fi ships as well?
Yeah, there's something called the Sci-Fi Sea Cruise, which is sailing from the 5th of December from Miami to San Juan, Puerto Plata, Antigua, St. Martin, San Croix, and San Lucia on Royal Caribbean's newly upgraded Explorer of the Seas. This is a fan Dash-tastic voyage, and it is described as Doctor Who's most intimate event.
I think that's the problem with fandoms for me, is that the most intimate event for me with Doctor Who is me watching Doctor Who by myself, or me watching Star Trek by myself. I find that sort of communication and the readings and what I get out of it is far more on a personal level. I find it very difficult in convention spaces to care about these other people who have a similar interest, but I already have that interest. You've got nothing to give me. I already have that. So what have you got to give me? weird, quirky stories, attempts to create sort of gatekeeping or hierarchies around fandom, a chance to show off the action figure you just bought. There's not much here that you can gift me. Now, meeting sort of people within, sort of, as you say, the sort of the cast or crew or showrunners, there's interest there because they can give me something that those other people can't, which is because those other people have got what I've got, but those people haven't got what I've got, which is an experience, an understanding of a thing from a different perspective.
Yeah.
So for me, conventions are interesting in that space. The actual going on a cruise where I could meet other people who have the same knowledge as I, but are probably not as cool as me in my perspective. They might disagree. You know, no, I don't want that. I just don't need that. I don't want to be taking buffets with you. You know, you can. They're weird things, but people do them, don't they?
They seem to
be a growing thing. Especially as I say with those big American franchises, they do well.
This first started in 1988.
Really? I didn't know that they were so old. That's interesting.
Yeah. In my opinion, Doctor Who fandom's most intimate event was the passing of Patrick Troughton, but there you go.
Yeah, I know where you've gone there.
Recommendation time, James. Would you recommend Doctor Who A Dalek Awakens Escape Hunt?
I would say that I wonder whether people who are into escape rooms and perhaps not into Doctor Who would probably get more out of it than those who are into Doctor Who. Because these days, you know, most Doctor Who fans have seen a life-size Dalek. You know, they've seen sonic screwdrivers. It might not offer them as much as perhaps someone who's a little more casual.
Sure.
So I think that might be where I would sit with that. In terms of recommendations, I'm watching Shogun on Disney Plus, who I will mention because they've yet to whack me with heavy advertisements.
Right.
And that's been very interesting in the approach to that show. And some weird choices as well. I'll say this just very quickly, because in the book, if people don't know, Shogun is about 17th century Japan and a character from the West. I suppose you could almost call it a Farscape / Buck Rogers / Flash Gordon approach of someone foreign to a country entering into this new world and learning and becoming part of that sort of cultural society, right, and bringing their own stuff to that space as well, in the way that those sort of science fiction shows do as well. And it's very good, but one of the problems it has, and it's a really interesting one, is that the main character is a British character who's working for a Dutch fleet.
Right.
And in Japan at that time, the Portuguese and the Spanish, specifically the Portuguese, are there as well. So the subtitles are for the Japanese, which obviously there's a lot of Japanese speaking through it. But when he is speaking to other characters who are Portuguese, it's still spoken as English and the subtitles are as English.
What?
And given that some of the complexities around the story are around these linguistic barriers, that he speaks Portuguese, but he's actually British born, and so he's got a British accent, and some of the Portuguese speakers sound quite British as well, it kind of feels really murky funnily enough, the non-Japanese languages within that story. You know, and I know some of you'd say, well, it's just a conceit that the audience get, that because they all probably speak English, that they don't want to see suddenly a character speaking in Portuguese with subtitles as well. But I feel if your story is all about the barriers of culture and language and societies, you need to and you're playing it as true to the book as, and they're doing a really good job of it. You got to do it. You got to have them speaking Portuguese and just have subtitles for the English people watching it, because that's it. It's really weird. It just feels like a step back on a show which has really done a really good adaptation of Clavell's book. But anyway, I'm watching that and it's cool.
Okay. I mean, if I'm going to do a recommendation this week, then I would have to say it would be a video game.
Okay.
And it would be the RoboCop game.
Oh, right. Okay. We talked about it, didn't we, a couple of weeks ago?
We briefly talked about it a few weeks ago, yeah. So it was on offer on the Steam Summer Sale. So I've picked it up. It's called Rogue City. It's on Steam. I'm not sure if it's on any other platform, but it starts off with a nice bit of news in the RoboCop tradition, and then there's a bit of there's an OCP person on the news as well, and then it takes you into the mission. And there's a little bit of exposition at the beginning, probably too much exposition for my liking. But once you actually get in control of RoboCop, it's really good.
Oh, cool. That's interesting.
Yeah. So I've enjoyed that so far. So, and I got recommendation for that myself from someone I used to, when I used to do the tech podcast, they recommended it to me. So I'm pleased that they did, because it turned out to be quite good.
Oh, that's good. I mean, I don't know if we said last podcast, I watched Frozen Empire, the Ghostbusters one. And,
yeah.
And that was, as a franchise, kind of disappointing. And it's nice to hear other sort of long-term franchising creating material, which, you know, still gives a bit of vitality to the franchise.
Indeed. Cool. Indeed. Excellent. Okay, so that brings us to the end of this week's Casterbris. We'll be back next time. Until then, it's goodbye.